This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you spend long stretches of time at the Great Salt Lake, you can tell. It's changing. The colors are different these days, they say. The way it moves is different. The way it smells. The lake is receding. An erratic climate, a persistent drought, more and more water diverted from its tributaries has brought it to a turning point. Declining is the word Scott Baxter chose this week. One of those words you use to describe the health of a loved one. Baxter is a photographer and a kayaker, and the Great Salt Lake is one of his favorite places to paddle. As he moves across the lake through bays and wetlands and across open water, he takes pictures of the birds and animals and the wild views. And being out there, he saw it coming.
Those of us that are familiar with the lake have seen for years that the lake is declining. There was no question that the lake would hit a record low. And I'd committed to myself when that happened, I would circumnavigate the lake.
In late July, it happened. The lake reached its lowest level ever, or for as long as they've been measuring it. So last week, Scott Baxter set out. He had with him a partner, Matt, and two wooden sea kayaks he built himself. He figured it would take 6 days.
On the morning of the 29th, we drove down to the marina. The first thing you see are all these sailboats and dry dock. There's no water, it's just mud. Kind of like seeing a restaurant with nobody eating in it. We paddled out of the marina, had seagulls all around us. It was cool, there was a slight breeze, there was the scent of brine, there were shorebirds around. We got a little ways away from I-80 and the railroad and all the noise and really started to immerse ourselves into the lake experience. We saw the eared grebe, a very significant bird this time of year on the lake. American avocet flying overhead. Rock formations poking up out of the water. They're called microbialites. They're the platform for the entire food chain on the lake. That's what the brine fly and the brine shrimp graze off of. And they were exposed, protruding up out of the lake. Seagulls sitting on them. And I've been seeing them for a couple years now, but never like this year where you can see them for hundreds of yards. When they become exposed, they die. We landed on Eardley's Bit, and a rogue wave came in. Splashed over the top of my kayak, and it left it just covered in dead brine shrimp, and my cockpit just full of dead brine shrimp. I think that was our introduction to this is going to be an interesting trip. From Early Spit, we went up the west side of the lake, past Carrington Island, an island that was actively used for bomb testing in World War II, and there's a high potential of live ordnance that has not been exploded on that island, so we paddled past that and up past Hat Island. None of these islands are really islands anymore. The water's dropped enough that basically they're just high spots on mud flats now attached to the shore of the lake. We ended up camping on the north end of Stansbury Island. The wind howled all night. Woke up in the morning to sea foam had piled up. It was covering the shores. It was 2 to 3 feet deep in most places. For Matt, that was a special surprise. He'd never experienced that. It was fun to play in it, similar to what I did 30 years ago, the first time I experienced it. We woke up in the morning and decided to take a 15-mile crossing to breach in the railroad causeway. In the late 50s, they built an earth-filled causeway that spanned the lake over to Promontory Point, then from Promontory Point again to the east shore of the lake. And it essentially split the lake in half. The north end is a whole different world. There's no tributaries that come in there. It's 27% salt, full saturation of salt. We camped there near the causeway, and the next morning we went to go through the breach in the causeway under the bridge. There was a wind coming out of the north, so there was big breaking waves just on the other side of the bridge. We pedaled hard and crashed through the waves coming through. This is all happening at about 6 o'clock in the morning. It was still dark, but the water seemed dark purple to us. As the sun came up, you could see the bright red of the water in the North Gunnison Bay. And that comes from the algae and whatnot that live in the water there. That water is so saline that even the extreme organisms that live in the south end of the lake, for the most part, can't live in the north end of the lake. We paddled through that red water. And our destination was to be close to Gunnison Island, rookery for American white pelican. It's a significantly historic island. Stansbury built one of his triangulation stations when he was mapping the lake there, and a very famous early artist of the Utah area, Lamborn, basically built a small rock shack there and lived there for some time, kind of existing in that space between absolute reality and insanity that most artists tend to explore as they try to push their skill in art. We landed probably a mile and a half, maybe 2 miles south and to the east of Gunnison Island. The microbialites, the rock structures that we'd seen in the south end of the lake, also existed in the north end of the lake. As far as you could see, to the west, to the north, to the south, these very beautiful structures just covered in salt crystals. And under the water, you could see the same thing. And you're looking through this pinkish, kind of like raspberry lemonade colored water, looking down at them. We were still a long ways from dry land there, so we climbed out on a couple big ones, and that's where we ate lunch. We pulled our fruit out of our boats, and we made our lunch there, and just enjoyed the beauty. The lake is full of mysteries, full of surprises. You see things you don't see anywhere. You explore things you couldn't explore anywhere. The trip was difficult. Probably averaged 10 to 12 miles between points where we got out on this trip. And that's a long time to be in a kayak paddling hard. You get discouraged. And every time that discouragement would capture both of us, the lake would dish out one of these surprises for us, one of these magical moments. The lake was dishing out waves and wind, letting us know, you know, something after a lifetime of climbing and sea kayaking that I've learned. You don't conquer mountains. You don't conquer seas. The sea or the mountain allows you to trespass. And I think the first few days, the lake was telling us that. You know, you have to understand you're trespassing. And when you understand that, then you'll get to share in some of the beauty and some of the magic. We continued up the west side of the lake. We were seeing magical things all along the way. Foam on the surface of the lake, which is very common on the north end of the lake. And inside this foam were these perfect pyramids of solid crystals that were kind of upside down pyramids and hollow that had formed, protected by the foam, keeping the waves and stuff from breaking the solid crystals apart. We went up past Spiral Jetty. It's a beautiful area on the lake. We camped just outside of Indian Cove, another just absolutely magical area. That was our last night on the north end of the lake. So Matt, who was with me, had only been on the lake once before, and that was a few days before this trip when we made a trip out to Fremont Island just kind of as a test run. Matt couldn't resist the opportunity to swim in the lake. You're buoyant in the south end of the lake. In the north end of the lake, you're extremely buoyant. And he'd never experienced either. He was out there hollering and hooting and just having a great time. So I had to hurry and get out there and enjoy a float myself. We got out just as the sun was setting and just went to sleep. We were just exhausted. The next morning, we came over the causeway right at the edge of the lake. And we got into the water, and the first thing you see is just an incredible field of these microbialites that are dead, very dead. These ones aren't ones that have came out of the water recently. These are ones that probably came out a year ago. The ones that were still partially alive were interesting, and it was interesting to look at their structure and whatnot. These ones that were really dead. It was a hard feeling. It was hard to see him that way. It was also really hard from a kayaking standpoint, because that meant we had to go actually probably 4 miles out to get around this mass before we could turn in the direction that we planned on going in. We did that, and we worked our way down the Fremont Island. And Fremont Island's kind of a neat place, too. I like Fremont Island. There's a lot of history there. When Fremont first explored the lake, he actually named it Disappointment Island. They had a terrible experience on that island. They spent the night before they went out to the island dreaming of the exotic plants and animals they would discover on the island and what the experience would be. They found an island that was pretty barren. They were thirsty. They were hungry. They'd had a bad storm going across. They had a miserable experience there, and he called it Disappointment Island. One of the people that was with him on that trip was Kit Carson, and Kit Carson, on a prominent rock, carved a cross. He was a recent convert to the Catholic Church and a very gung-ho Catholic, and he carved a cross there. Contrary to popular belief, Catholics actually beat the Mormons to the valley here. We made it to Farmington Bay that night. Next morning, got back in our boats and headed down the west side of Antelope Island, one of my favorite places to paddle. This morning, the sun was in our eyes, so there wasn't much to see. But what we were seeing and were the eared grebes again. When we were going out, we saw eared grebes. They'd be in little groups of 3 or 4. Now they were numerous. 4.5 million grebes. We could follow a line of maybe 30 miles of eared grebes. It's an incredible sight to see that many birds and and understand right now their entire population is relying on that lake. So if that lake fails, that entire population will fail with it. We paddled through and around these reefs. As we moved to the south end of the lake, we could hear the trains again. We could hear the traffic again. We came to the marina and we paddled up to the ramp and got out of our boats. There were several people that would have liked to have made that a media moment. And we said, no, let's have the media moment later. Let's let the trip be the trip. And the lake defined the trip.
Scott Baxter. He and his paddling partner, Matt Kahabka, completed their journey around the Great Salt Lake earlier this week. It took them 6 days. Today in the program, we're updating the condition of the Great Salt Lake. Now that we're at the end of the water year, we were hoping to find out the prognosis for the lake. We're also hoping to talk about just how that ecosystem works, because we figured if you're going to understand the stakes in this story, you have to understand the cycle that could be disrupted if the pillars that support it start to fall. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Utah's state legislative session is just 45 days long. That is not a lot of time to get all the business done, Sonia.
Not at all, Emily. It is a very complicated process, and a lot needs to happen in those few weeks. On the next episode of State Street, we're learning about what goes into that short legislative session and whether the process still holds up.
Find State Street wherever you listen to podcasts or go to KUER.org/State Street.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the web of life that depends on the Great Salt Lake. Like any intricate system of nature, there's an equilibrium that can get thrown off by even minor disruptions. And here are the disruptions facing the lake right now: a warming planet, an unrelenting drought, more and more water being diverted from the rivers that feed the lake. In July, it reached its lowest point in recorded history. But even an unusually wet August couldn't slow that decline. As we've been talking about on the show, scientists are right now trying to determine just how long before the lake becomes too salty or too dry to sustain life. It's never been a dead lake, but if it does actually die, it could set off a wave of cascading disasters. We have with us this week Bonnie Baxter. She's a professor of biology at Westminster College, also director of the Great Salt Lake Institute, and Jamie Butler. She's a coordinator at the Institute. Jamie Butler said things are changing on the lake, and that if you visit there, you can see it for yourself.
It's not just the one snapshot that you see little bumps coming out of the water and lots of exposed shorelines. It's the rate of change that going out to the lake and seeing it disappearing right in front of my eyes is really what's scary. That over time, there's, instead of seeing water and being able to walk on the beach, there's miles of exposed shorelines and, you know, the microbialites that are popping out of the water everywhere.
Glenn, what do you see or don't
see?
Well,
yeah, I think I agree. Like we at Great Salt Lake Institute, we're probably out at the lake every week at least, and we go to various sites around the lake. And by the time you get back to the same site you went to a couple weeks ago, it's completely changed. The shoreline has shrunk more, and you have to walk more when you're trying to get to the water to take water samples or do the work we do with our students. And I agree that that's shocking, the rate of change. And part of that is it's such a shallow lake. So once it starts shrinking, you know, the evaporation rate is so high because it's shallow and so much of the water is exposed to the air.
Jamie, one of the things you told us is that the lake, this is how you put it, hardly stinks anymore. And for you, you say that smell kind of means life. What do you mean? What are you not smelling out there?
Yeah, when you drive out to Antelope Island across the causeway, it used to be that you would be smacked in the face with that Great Salt Lake smell early on in that causeway. Mm. And now, you know, you start to smell the lake once you cross it. I mean, that place where you smell the lake is just very different. And to me, that smell means life and, you know, death. There's an incredible amount of life and biomass in Great Salt Lake, either the, you know, cyanobacteria and the microbes that make Farmington Bay smell so ripe and gnarly and wicked is maybe a good smell. To, you know, sometimes in Great Salt Lake, there's the biomass at one time in brine shrimp of 1.8 million people. So, wow. I mean, at one time in Great Salt Lake, and when those shrimp die, you know, it smells, but it means that there was this incredible life that is just going through its natural cycles.
And now that's dissipating in some way?
To me, I mean, I think it's those shifting shorelines. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see what happens next year, because we're at this place right now where we're seeing all of the microbialites that are exposed. And that's one part of this weekly linked food chain, double food chain at Great Salt Lake. And probably that's going to mean a shift in what can live in Great Salt Lake. There's not going to be as many flies that munch on those microbialites. And I mean, what will the birds eat? The birds come here to eat those brine flies and then brine shrimp that make up the other arm of the Great Salt Lake's food chain. So those brine shrimp are feeding on algae that's in the water, and they're kind of just floating on currents and filter feeding algae out of the main body of Great Salt Lake in the water column. And then birds like eared grebes are coming to feast on them. So we're at this place where microbialites are exposed, and some people call it a graveyard of microbialites out at the Great Salt Lake right now.
Do you call it that?
It looks like it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very good way to picture it.
So it sounds like we're at a place that it seems really bad, but we're not quite sure how bad.
So first of all, just about the smell, I think the shifting shorelines are, that's one part of the answer. But I also think it has to do with increasing salinity. And this plays into the whole picture that we'll talk about today. But as the shorelines shrink, as the water evaporates, the salts get more concentrated. And so we're seeing the salinity go up as the summer has progressed and we move into fall. And that means different microorganisms are present, and maybe not as many of the ones that, you know, degrade the biomass and turn it over. So some of those benthic microbes that are usually on the bottom doing turnover for nutrients for the lake are probably struggling at the salinity levels. So salinity is such a driver for biodiversity in aquatic systems. So I think as we change salinity, we're going to see different microbial compositions, and that it's like a different community of microbes are going to be there than was there at the start of the summer. And I think that's in part maybe a shift in the smell. So it is interesting to use your nose as a scientific instrument, right? But you asked me, how do I frame this? What do I see? So I think we're doing an experiment, and we won't have the results of this experiment until next spring and summer. So we have basically beached the microbialites that where the brine flies pupate, And we now see desiccated, dried up pupa on these dry rocks instead of a living ecosystem. So they're just salted out on the shores. So the brine fly population can completely crash. So if they don't come back next year, we'll know why, right?
Yeah. Let's back up and have you take me through how this life cycle works out there. You've both talked about how there are the two basic different, and they're, as you said, weakly linked, but they're these two different food chains at play here. Let's start with the first one, microbolites. Like, what is a microbolite?
I'll let Bonnie take this one.
All right. I'll talk about microbiolites. So we say
microbiolite.
Yeah, so yeah, microbial is like an adjective, and ite is what geologists add to things to make it a rock, like a meteorite. Right? So microbiolite is literally a rock made by microbes. So these have been likened to coral in the ocean because it's something living that makes something that is inanimate, a calcium carbonate rock. But these micro...
Jamie called it a grungy sister to coral. I like
that.
Oh,
yeah, I do like a grungy sister to coral. That's a good one, Jamie. Yeah.
And, you know, the boaters and the brine shrimp harvesters call them reefs.
Yeah, huh? Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're living rocks, essentially. These microbial mats exist on them and help build them. They do photosynthesis, and that changes the chemistry, which allows the rock to form. So they're really kind of one part biology and one part geology. But the significance in the food chain is, you know, brine shrimp and brine flies eat off of them, but particularly the flies. Brine shrimp can eat other things in the water column, but the brine flies use them to pupate. And the pupa are exactly like a cocoon for a butterfly. So the brine flies lay eggs on the surface of the water, and then they hatch into little larvae, which look like little caterpillars that swim around in the ocean. So that thing we learned about butterflies and metamorphosis happens with brine flies. So they lay eggs and they become these little thrashing caterpillars in the water, these little larvae. And then they go and eat off these microbial mats on the microbiolites. And then they find a spot they like and they attach to it and they form what looks like a cocoon. It's a little brine fly pupa on the bottom of the lake under the water. And so they're ducks that eat the larva when they're swimming around thrashing in the water column, and they're ducks that dive down and scrape the pupa off the rocks. So they're really important in the life of birds and the diet. They're really important in the diet of birds. But then the pupa detach and float up to the surface, and out comes a brine fly. And then those get eaten by other birds on the shore. You'll see gulls running down the shore with their mouths open, kicking the brine flies up and just ingesting as many as they can. So at every stage of its life cycle, it's some kind of food for some kind of bird. And so if you dry all these out, and you don't provide the microbiolites for them to latch onto to pupate, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. We just see this in action. We're seeing it happen right now. We're doing the grand experiment. Jamie should talk about the brine shrimp life cycle.
Well, and I just wanted to reiterate the importance of microbiolites. They're 30% of the primary productivity from Great Salt Lake. So is that right, Bonnie?
I don't think we know the exact number from our new study, so that's going to be revisited, but I think that's about right in current estimates.
Okay, so, you know, we're a huge amount of the primary productivity is coming from those. That's going to be gone this year.
So microbiolites are underwater.
So they're
ideally, but fairly shallow water.
Yeah, they photosynthesize, so they need the sun.
Yeah.
And so they have to be in shallow water where sun can reach them.
But if it gets obviously so shallow that they dry up, So it seems like a really delicate balance going on. Mm-hmm.
They're really canaries. Yeah. They're canaries in the coal mine because they're the first thing that will be impacted as the lake margins shrink, you know? And so back in high school, when you took biology, you learned about trophic levels, and what is always at the bottom of any food chain is something that does photosynthesis, whether it's a plant in a land ecosystem or algae in an aquatic ecosystem. And so that's the same lesson for Great Salt Lake. So somebody needs to work in the ecosystem to bring the energy of the sun into the system, and that's what these microbialites do.
Okay, let's get to the second food chain, brine shrimp. Tell us about brine shrimp, Jamie.
Brine shrimp are very cool little macroinvertebrates. I have studied for over 20 years. These brine shrimp, at the end of the season, they...
You don't see them as having a kind of personality, do you?
I don't, but I did. You know, one of the things that we found out while I was studying them is that some of the females have up to 300 live young or eggs in their brood sac at one time. And so while I was sitting there counting these, I was pregnant with my son that's 20 now. And that was a little bit of a, it kind of messed my mind up a little bit when I was opening up other creatures and I had one in my own.
Can I just interject here? Because Jamie doesn't only like to think about the anatomy of female brine shrimp. There's some real specific things that are different about the anatomy of male brine shrimp. Could you comment on that, Jamie?
Well, male brine shrimp have two penises. Huh. And we don't know why. I know you're thinking right now, why? I'm thinking that too, and I don't know that. But they do have two penises, and I think that that's kind of interesting.
Very. All right, keep going. So, okay. So now we know they have two penises. Interesting brood sacks. Keep going.
And so,
no personalities.
And our brine shrimp are sexually reproducing. So you have the males and the females, yeah. And they, in good environments, they will lay up to 300 eggs. They will release those or live young into the environment. And then all of those adults die off at the end of the season when it gets cold. And what remains are these hard-shelled eggs that are kind of akin to an M&M. They're like a hard outside shell and a soft embryonic center. And those little embryos can float around in Great Salt Lake, and that hard shell protects them from drying out. It protects them from the sun. It protects them from everything, and a lot of things. And brine shrimp harvesters go out and they scoop those floating cysts or eggs off the surface of Great Salt Lake and send them around the world for use in commercial aquaculture. So 40 to 60% of the world's need for brine shrimp in commercial aquaculture to make food for humans is coming off of Great Salt Lake.
Wow. Well, let's get to the creatures, the animals and this gets us to grebes, which I know are a big favorite of yours.
Yeah.
Is it true that in some ways, eared grebes, that's the thing that drew you to the lake?
That's how I got started working at Great Salt Lake, and I just never left. I was working with Utah State University, and they were contracted through the Department of Natural Resources to try to understand if brine shrimp harvesters were leaving enough brine shrimp in the lake for these eared grebes.
Yeah.
So eared grebes, they come here and they molt their feathers and they lose their ability to fly, and they just dive to eat brine shrimp. They feed primarily on brine shrimp and really eat.
They gorge.
They
right?
gorge 22 to 30,000 brine shrimp that they have to eat every day to get their body in adequate conditions for migration and reproduction. And
wait, so you've got 5 million grebes eating 30,000 brine shrimp every single day.
Yeah. Isn't that cool?
It's cool.
And to put it into perspective, grebes, they forage for about 7 hours a day. So every time they dive, every second they dive, they have to pick two brine shrimp out of the water individually. It's pretty amazing. So you have to have a high density of brine shrimp if you're going to be able to maintain that. And it turns out that the state of Utah and the Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Program that's under the Department of Natural Resources has been managing and monitoring brine shrimp harvest for over 25 years. And they've actually actually optimized harvest, and at the same time, that benefits grebes.
This is one of those cases where you have industry actually asking the state to regulate them.
Weird, huh?
Weird, yeah.
And it's really cool. And they've worked in partnership. They don't always agree on everything,
sure,
but they really have worked with a common goal of a sustainable Great Salt Lake for birds and people. So we're harvesting more brine shrimp than ever. We're leaving enough for all of these eared grebes that come here and have actually increased in numbers over the past 20 years. They've doubled since I was on the lake.
Why?
When I started. I think because we have this fantastic brine shrimp resource, and saline lakes across the West are shrinking and desiccating. And so Great Salt Lake is one of the only places that they have to go.
All right, so finish the story of the grebe, because I love what happens toward the end, that they're disrupting radar. There are so many in the air.
Yeah, there's so many. By about Thanksgiving, all of the shrimp have died off and they start working out. They've gained all of this weight and they're really fat and kind of squishy, and they kind of have like little Daffy Duck cheeks, you know, they're really adorable. They start working out and flapping their wings and build up their wing muscles again. And over a 3-week period, those 5 million eared grebes take off and fly south. And so many of them leave at one time, and they leave at night. You can't go and see them during the day. You have to see them on weather radar. And they do. Oftentimes the weather people on the news will say, oh, the birds are migrating. It's most likely those eared grebes.
Jamie Butler. She's a coordinator at the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College. Also with us is Bonnie Baxter. She's director of the Institute. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Great Salt Lake hit a record low in late July, but it didn't stop there. Scientists have been tracking this, and they say if the pace of decline persists, the deposits and microbes that sustain that ecosystem will desiccate and die. And the foundation of that network will start to collapse. And that means millions of stranded birds. It means clouds of toxic dust. We were told if the lake drops 2 more feet by November, we could be at a point of no return. And so far, despite a wet August and a change of season, the lake has continued to shrink another 1.3 feet as of this week. We're talking about the ecosystem, and we're updating the lake's prognosis this week. We have with us Bonnie Baxter. She's director of the Great Salt Lake Institute, also a professor of biology at Westminster College, and Jamie Butler. She's a coordinator at the Institute.
Let's talk about sort of where we stand right now. Bonnie, last time we talked a few weeks ago, I asked how close are we to this tipping point? And you said that it was possible we could reach that tipping point by November, by next month. You said that the low point of the lake comes in November, and that we'll know then whether we've lost, basically, I think it was like 2 feet of elevation. That's a critical point. What do we know right now in October as you look into November about how close we might be to a tipping point?
I think when I talked to you, the lake had just hit this historic low of matching the historic low of 1963, which was 4,191.3 feet. That's a number that's kind of burned in our memory. I know it might not be something your listeners can recite, but 4,191.3 was a big deal. So we hit that, and now we have, as of this week, gone down another foot to 4,190.4, I think, when I looked at it earlier this week. So I think our predictions of having lost 2 feet during the rest of this summer by November, I think we're right on track with that. We know what's happening, you know. We're sounding the alarms because we're seeing it happen before our eyes. We're doing this huge experiment.
But of course, you're hearing what a lot of people are saying is, and this is another indicator of how weird climate change can be, what its effect is, but it's, we had the wettest August in like 38 years. We had all these monsoonal rains, and I think a lot of people were thinking, oh, it's going to help the lake. But Bonnie, it doesn't sound like it did at all.
No, I think direct precipitation is really great for the lake because you don't have to wait for it to, you know, go through the watershed and be used upstream before it gets to the lake. So a direct precipitation is great, but not in the summer and not when it comes all in one day. A trickle is better. And that is because it just comes at a time where evaporation rates are really high. So it's better to have a constant trickle into the lake than, you know, one day with a lot of rain. And I think that's the kind of rain we saw in August.
And I guess I would add to, you know, what you're talking about and say, even if we got a really wet winter and we had tons of snow in our mountains, we probably won't see a very big increase in Great Salt Lake even next year, because our reservoirs are going to fill up, our groundwater is going to be recharged, and just, you know, the system is just so dry that it's going to kind of soak all that water up before it goes to Great Salt Lake. And so, you know, realistically, we're still looking at some years of pretty dire times in salt content and lake levels of Great Salt Lake.
One of the other things we talked about, Bonnie, when we talked, I said, if you could say to the governor, what can we do? You said, get some water to the lake. But then you also said, look, I'm looking at this as a scientist. I'm not an expert on telling people how to get that water to the lake, but I did want to hear both of you on that point, which is to say, what is it that state leaders, legislators, other people can do to get some water to the lake?
Well, Jamie and I have been working pretty hard at reaching out and trying to connect people in these conversations, and we've been involved with folks in the legislature, I think for the first time, really people interested in going out to the lake and seeing what's going on. And that's encouraging to me. The other thing is,
Bonnie, can I just say on that point, though, now, I don't know how many lawmakers you've had out there, but I've heard Derek Kitchens, I've heard you've taken Brian King. They're all Democrats.
Right.
I'm not sure their sensibility about the lake is any different from Republicans, but are Republicans also going out to the lake and seeing those problems as well?
You know, we did take Derek out and we're meeting with Brian King in a lunch meeting. Okay. So that's a point that, you know, maybe these people are already prone to fight for the lake. Tim Hawks is a Republican representative who has been really working hard on this issue, and there are other Republicans that I think are super interested in the lake or connected to the industries that work on the lake. And I've only heard, you know, we want to help. The question is how to help and what to do.
And maybe this is our invitation to lawmakers who have a stake in Great Salt Lake, which is everybody in 22,000 square miles of watershed. We'll take you to the lake.
Yes, we will.
Tell you, you know, about how cool it is and how weird it is and how important
And if I could ask the governor to call us, because he's hard to get to, and we really would love to talk to him about Great Salt Lake or take him out there. And I know that a lot of stuff is going on in conversations with legislators, and some of this is still behind the scenes. I know that there's some action afoot, and I appreciate that. And I think that many people are paying attention to the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council. So this is something that was the brainchild of Governor John Huntsman back in the day, and he put together a group of folks to develop legislation because the lake is monitored by so many different state agencies that Huntsman felt as if it needed to be pulled together by some group that could look at all of these entities. So I was on a committee that he put together to help write this legislation. And this Great Salt Lake Advisory Council is doing exactly what it should do. And so we need to give a high five to John Huntsman for that. And it is advising us what are the best strategies to save this lake. And so they have produced a document with 12 strategies, and they are giving this to everybody who will listen. And so part of this involves like thinking about people upstream. Could we buy water rights and save them for the lake, for example?
Do any of those strategies include doing something about the fact that a significant draw on the, you know, the tributary water that could get to the lake is going to agriculture, is going to development? Is there is this one of the reasons it's hard to get politicians to return your calls? Is because you're talking with some fairly crucial things. It's agriculture and development. That's tough.
It's tough, but all the water doesn't get used. So what if there were incentives to conserve that water and sell your water rights, for example? Mm. So it doesn't have to be that people are at odds. Saving Great Salt Lake should matter to everybody who lives along the Wasatch Front. You're going to be breathing the dust that used to be this lake. So you really ought to care about it. So I have not spoken to farmers and ranchers and folks like, you know, their representatives have. But I've got to believe that there are incentives that could incentivize us all to work on this problem. And I think one of the base level problems is we don't measure this water. So we don't really even quantify water rights. We don't even really understand that, how much water is going in what direction. So that's important. And then this idea of could we convince folks upstream to preserve that water right for Great Salt Lake? And could we actually get a water right for Great Salt Lake so that it has a right to have, you know, X number of feet of elevation? I think those are some of the things we're going to see movement on in the legislature one way or another.
Do you think it seems like there's often a theme or a few big themes in a legislative session? Are you hoping that one of the big themes for the legislative session, you know, coming up is fix the problem that the drastic conditions of Great Salt Lake?
I would love to see it just based on water in Utah, because it really, I mean, is a problem all across Utah and being exacerbated by the drought we're in. But, you know, all of it leads to Great Salt Lake. And I think that here, you know, people have been asking us, like, do you have hope or do you think that it's just going to disappear? And I have hope, and I think we're set up for success. People have been working on this problem through state agencies in partnership with lots of different organizations and academia, and we know what the strategies are that are going to switch the system. And I think that we're set up for success, and it's time to really take action. I mean, I wish it would have happened 10 years ago, but we have it in our power to do that now and decide the fate of Great Salt Lake.
Bonnie, final word.
I agree that water is the most important issue that's facing Utah. And if our state legislature and our governor, you know, can't make that priority one, then they're really not fighting for the people of Utah, not to mention the brine shrimp of Utah, who don't have a representative.
Save the shrimp.
Bonnie Baxter, Jamie Butler, thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bonnie Baxter is the director of the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College. She's also a professor of biology there. The biologist Jamie Butler is a coordinator for the Institute. Radio West is a production of KUER. Our intern is Stu Nolan, the program produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
I was not prepared at all for what I saw on this trip. I just simply wasn't prepared to see the impact of the decline of the water. You could look 300-400 yards to see where the lake edge was last year at this time. Huge fields of microbialites completely exposed. I can't imagine we will have a good enough year to fill the reservoirs with water and have anything left over for the lake. And the lake will drop about 2 feet each year if it's not replenished with water. It will just simply die. You know, I've always thought of the lake as being somewhat invincible. We've thrown every nasty thing at it that we can, and it just seems to keep chugging along. And for the first time, not academically, but from a very personal standpoint, I realized just how threatened this lake was.